Welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, while the economic sanctions on Russia for its invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea are substantial, there is another economic war that Russia is waging on the West. What exactly is this war? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February in 2022, Western nations led by the United States imposed a significant level of economic sanctions against the Russians. Many of these were increased sanctions that were originally imposed following Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea and subsequent support for Russophone insurgents in the eastern Ukraine region known as the Donbass. But these sanctions are imposed in a larger context. Russia has been locked in an economic battle with the United States and its allies. Driven by concerns of American domination of the global economic system, Russia has been leading a coalition to try to challenge the U.S. On today's show, we interview the author of a new book which details this economic conflict, placing the sanctions regime imposed by the West in the context of this much larger conflict. Maximilian Hess is a Central Asia Fellow in the Eurasia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and the founder of a London-based political risk firm, Enmetenna Advisory. And most importantly, he's the author of a new book just has come out called Economic War, Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. Professor Hess, thank you very much for joining us. If I may, Max, these sanctions, the way that so many of us have been following this issue, were sort of seen as a tool of economic statecraft on the part of the United States and the U.S. kind of leading a Western alliance with quite a bit of European support in imposing some pretty harsh sanctions as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But you see this in a much larger context. Could you talk about what that context is?
Yeah, certainly. And thank you again for having me. I think that the context that I try to lay out is that we can argue and debate about whether there's an international rules-based order, a term that has become so closely associated with this conflict, both from the Western side saying it's defending it to the Russian side saying that it doesn't exist. And, you know, my view is sort of, well, we can debate that, but what really matters is how the international economy works and where the U.S. derives its geopolitical power from. And in my view, that really comes from the dollar system and the dollar status and place as the reserve currency in that international order. Now, Russia has long chafed at this order. The sort of origins of this conflict actually, in my view, go back to 2012, when in removing the last economic sanctions that were still imposed on Russia, actually as a legacy of the Soviet Union, the U.S. imposed the Magnitsky Act, targeting a group of Russian kleptocrats who had murdered a lawyer who was involved and were also involved in the looting of some funds from an American-owned asset management company. As this escalated, it really coincided with the revolution in Ukraine in 2013 and 2014, and Russia seeking to use its knowledge and understanding of the system that it had gained since its introduction into the capitalist and international economic order after the Soviet Union's collapse to its own advantage and to try to turn that system against it. So, you know, the sanctions were very much the West's key tool, and I think their understanding changed and has changed as a result of this conflict from sort of the latest evidence, which I think has actually been long established, that they don't work as a deterrent tool, but they do work as a tool of statecraft and targeting another country. Country's capabilities and capacity, as well as Russia's own actions, which, you know, most prominently have included the turning on and turning off of gas, targeting other exports, more recently in Ukraine, of course, with the grain situation as we speak right now, but also with its financial engineering, with using the tools that underpin that international economic order, from the contracts of how one government borrows to another, to the international financial institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank that essentially keep things humming along and, of course, usually bail out countries when they encounter difficulties, so long as they continue to abide by that order, and which, of course, Russia experienced itself in 1998 with its default.
Now, we'll get into some of the details, but I want to stay a little bit large and meta when we first start here. And that you go in a number of these specific instances, you know, is Russia responding to sanctions and, you know, economic statecraft that are meant to punish or potentially deter them? You know, in particular in 2014 around Crimea and around Donbass. But I guess one of the big questions is, how much is this challenge to American domination, this dollar dominance and the domination of Americans, is it just reactive to the fact the U.S. is using tools of economic statecraft? Or is the context sort of much larger in the sense that it's not just that Russia is just reacting to U.S. sanctions, but instead see this as a much bigger global competition that even if the annexation of Crimea hadn't have happened, we would have seen a lot of these campaigns?
You know, I think that it may not have escalated the way it has escalated without the annexation of Crimea and that initial invasion of Ukraine in 2014. But one of the things that I try to detail is how Putin has actually long complained about the dollar system and how he sees the U.S.'s what is known as exorbitant privilege, a term coined actually by a former French president, and its unique role in this international economic order, where it basically does set a lot of the key rules of those economic functions, some of which I describe in detail in the book. But, you know, I think that we've seen Putin complain about this from very early in his presidency. But what also I think is quite interesting is that Putin, you know, while he's so well known as this man of the KGB, sort of the spy who came in from the cold, and sort of that, he had very useful business experience in the 1990s as the assistant to the mayor in St. Petersburg, bringing foreign business in, understanding them, actually being involved in one of the first Russian IPOs in a Western country. And Putin has studied and understood this system and chafed against it for a long time. And, you know, while there's no one individual publication to point to, like his, you know, diatribe about the historical unity of Russian and Ukrainian peoples that he published a year before the war and sort of lays out his vision of why it's justified to wage conflict to unite them, you know, there is a certain very large series of literature around the Kremlin and around Putin's own rhetoric and those of his close advisors who've long wanted to target this system. I do think it was not, it certainly wasn't the Obama administration's intention, and it actually didn't initially support the legislation that brought it in 2012. But Putin really saw that as an affront. And there's a quote that I cite of his where he says, well, if we take this slap in the face now, they'll keep on slapping us forever. And it's time for us to respond. So I think Putin would have all found other ways to escalate his challenge to this international economic order, attempts to find ways to weaken the dollar system, even without the Ukrainian crisis. But the Ukrainian crisis in 2014, Russia's invasion then, and the West's response triggered a series of mutually escalatory steps.
In the book, and of course, in a lot of the literature, we speak about this dollar domination, the way in which dollars dominate the system. Why is that? If it's not based on the fact that the U.S. created the rules and the institutions, which you seem to, you know, dismiss that one, or at least it's not nearly as emphasized, the system itself, but more the practice of power. Yeah. What is it about the dollar that gives it such a dominant position? And yeah, and then we'll talk about ways in which he's trying to weaken it.
You know, I think it's a really interesting point and one I hope to return to in the future about, you know, how the U.S. became so dominant in the system. And, you know, what really is, in my view, so important about the dollar is not even its function as the primary instrument of international trade, where it's about 60%, or the primary instrument of sovereign reserves, where it also is around that number, although has come down somewhat in the last 20 years, but doesn't show signs of losing its supremacy and is, you know, an order of magnitude larger than any other. But it's really the fact that the U.S.'s baseline interest rate, the U.S. Treasury rate, is the effective risk-free rate for the world. And there's a long history of sort of one country actually having that key role, even in eras before the sort of opening of international capital markets, which I'll come back to shortly after World War II. But you know, even before that, with British interest rates and gilt, UK government paper having been so dominant internationally and playing a huge role in the expansion of that empire, even going back to the city-state of Venice, which was the first country to really invent sovereign finance in this way and could therefore use a merchant republic to fund an international fleet that nobody else could compete with. But, you know, for the U.S., it really came into this dominant position after World War II with the creation of the Bretton Woods Agreement. But of course, at that time, there was still a peg between the dollar and gold, but all other currencies essentially had to be intermediated through the dollar to get that gold. Now, in the Nixon administration, the U.S. finally broke that peg and effectively ended that order as a result of increased demand for dollars and essentially that draining, you know, literally Fort Knox and the potential that that would cause an international economic crisis. But one of the interesting features is this wasn't an intentional decision to strengthen the dollar system. Nixon was actually trying to weaken the value of the dollar at the time and to get essentially this demand problem to go away. But what it did was it essentially made everybody else who was holding dollars now treat dollars as gold, and most significantly treat U.S. treasuries as that core system. So right when we talk about competition with China, you know, we always talk, oh, could they dump U.S. treasuries? You know, they hold so many. But I think it's very telling that China and Japan are the number one and number two holders of them, despite their radically different geopolitical approaches to the U.S. because of how important this international economic order is. With other institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank, you know, I think there's long been an understanding in Washington that influence over those would be geopolitically useful. You know, certainly, the IMF and the World Bank are UN institutions technically, but unlike the United Nations, which is headquartered in New York, they are both based in Washington, D.C. And I think that sort of tells a lot about in some ways, how they genuinely operate. The U.S. has a veto effectively over their, you know, senior appointments and bailout agreements that no other country has, but also how they are perceived by Russia and some other countries.
And then you make the reference to the 2012 legislation. That's the Magnitsky Act, correct? That seems to represent not just for Russia, for a number of countries. I know there's been, Russia's not alone in opposing this dollar domination and this desire to at least break some of the American control over the global economy. And one of the reasons cited, certainly within international relations, is the willingness of the U.S. to use this power. That the U.S. loves to use economic sanctions on issues, you know, ranging from trade disputes to, you know, to human rights questions. The Magnitsky Act, from what I understand, was a response to accusations of violations of human rights on the part of the Russian regime. So, first of all, how accurate is that description that the U.S. really does anger a number of other countries because they have this power and they love to use it, and they actually have the ability to really cause quite a bit of economic pain in that use, irrespective of whether it's justified because of, say, you know, human rights abuses?
So, I certainly think it's true that the U.S. has vastly expanded its use of sanctions and in many cases their scope over the last 30 years. Of course, there's a long history of them being used even before that. In the lead up to World War II against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Of course, one of the most famous cases in Cuba. I certainly take the view that there has been a lot of misuse of sanctions. I think there's often been hope that sanctions would serve as a deterrent tool. And, you know, some of the really interesting literature here, from Dan Dresner, who wrote The Sanctions Paradox maybe 20 years ago, is actually that, you know, sanctions are much more effective at coercing and getting countries that are closely allied with you or have genuine economic interdependence and some form of accountability for that regime. You know, maybe we'll come on to how that interdependence was viewed in Europe differently in a little bit later. But, we see that more recently with, European countries obviously opposing the Trump administration's unilateral revocation of the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, but still complying with the sanctions that it reimposed, because again, they're part of this, you know, dollar system and order, and the U.S. is unique in sort of having an extraterritorial approach to its sanctions. Anything that involves the dollar, which, as you know, we just discussed in that order, is most things in the international economy, in certainly in the U.S. Treasury and U.S. State Department's view. And so I'm a critic of some uses of sanctions, and especially the idea is that they can serve as a deterrent tool. Where I do think they are genuinely very effective is as a state capacity tool. And sometimes that, of course, has caused, you know, real humanitarian tragedies in some cases, like in Russia's case, where, you know, I certainly take the view that at this stage, you know, doing the most we can to stop Putin's invasion and war is what it sort of behooves the international community to do, and what is in the interest of international peace and security. And I do think they serve as a very effective state capacity tool there, and therefore are very clearly warranted. I think one of the things that we're sort of starting to see emerge more recently, and that has been a feature of various points in the past, is also the use of more carrots in addition to the sticks. And this is actually something Russia has been, you know, long been very effective at, using economic carrots and to sort of challenge and poke at this order in certain ways. And this, the story kind of begins with an example of that in Ukraine. So, you know, I certainly don't want to sound as I'm any kind of zealot against sanctions. And I think some other more recent literature has been far too critical of its potential tool. And, you know, in this case, it is a form of war by other means, and I certainly far prefer war by other means to try to hinder more conflict and aggression on Putin's behalf than I do direct kinetic involvement for any Western countries.
We're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book that's come out about the economic conflicts between Russia and the West with Maximilian Hess. He's the author of Economic War, Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. And so let's shift a little bit here in that, I mean, from the international relations perspective, and this is just good old-fashioned realism, you know, first day of a IR course. If a state like Russia is going to challenge this dominant state of like the United States, it's going to need some friends. And so a lot of the first half of your book highlights ways in which Russia, and you just talked about the use of carrots as a way to try to bring alliances on board, to try to bolster really a coalition aligned with Russia that could, you know, do economic battle with the U.S. So I kind of want to go through some of those and kind of start with, you talk about Ukraine and you put in the context of something called the Eurasia Economic Union. What was that campaign? And, you know, how does that draw some states in aligning with Russia and, of course, eventually Ukraine in conflict?
Well, so the Eurasian Economic Union was a program that Putin proposed well over a decade ago now, in the years before the Ukrainian Revolution of 2013 and 2014, the Euromaidan Revolution. The idea was really in some ways modeled on the European Union of building up this trade and economic bloc, although its proposals never got, you know, that far, and certainly it's proven to be far more limited ever since. But for Ukraine in 2013, you know, Ukraine was at the time seeking an association agreement with the European Union, including what's known as a DCFTA, a deep and comprehensive free trade agreement, that would have slowly over time integrated it far more into the European economy. The Russia was convinced to instead join the Eurasian Economic Union, its sort of opposite bloc, and claimed very aggressively that Ukraine joining the EU and the DCFTA would mean there would have to be tariffs between Russia and Ukraine. The steel factories that had traded across since, you know, well, most of them were built in the Soviet era, but of course, you know, links went back to Imperial Russia as well. But those trade networks would be broken, that it was a threat to the Russian economy and so on and so forth. And Putin actually imposed sanctions on Ukraine in 2013, you know, Yanukovych's Ukraine, and then also used eventually a series of carrots to ensure Yanukovych, you know, we can debate. There's certainly those who believed he was always going to go over to the Russian side, and I probably tend towards that as well. But to ensure that he ultimately did, even as the protests were raging in Kyiv. And, you know, sort of the story that I begin the book with is how the first protester was killed on the same day that Yanukovych left Kyiv to go to Moscow to meet with Putin, where Putin agreed to provide this $15 billion financing agreement to Ukraine in exchange, effectively, for, you know, Yanukovych at the time said, okay, we'll become an observer member of the Eurasian Economic Union with a view to joining it later, trying to manage the protests at the same time. But what was really interesting was how this loan was structured. It was structured as a Eurobond, which is the primary way that countries borrow from Western capital markets. A Eurobond just refers to a currency bond issued by a currency. A bond is a tradable loan in not its own currency. So Russia or Ukraine borrowing in dollars or euros and so forth all counts as a euro bond, and then almost entirely under English law and New York law. But what Russia did was it actually changed a few key sentences in these contracts, which are, you know, standard boilerplate and whose changes and additions are the subject of fierce and heated political debates by legal scholars and those who specialize in emerging market finance, because they can have huge implications for the financial operations of any country. And the way that Russia did this essentially gave it not only leverage over Ukraine, but blurred the line between the rules of how sovereign debt is restructured when it does have, when an economic crisis does necessitate that. So what it essentially was doing was positioning in itself not only to keep the Yanukovych administration economically beholden to it, but also to be sure that any attempt to go otherwise or any major economic crisis in the country, which it could cause by invading it, for example, would result in escalating this conflict to being one that was about these rules and these structures of the international economic order.
So, I mean, in light of that, the idea that the Ukrainians would reject such a deal, you know, leading to the Maidan revolution, actually suggests the Ukrainians knew exactly what was going on. There was a kind of a form of an economic entrapment with this, and they wanted to try to escape that level of Russian power over Ukraine, correct?
Yeah, I certainly view it that way. I mean, I was there in Kyiv myself during part of the Maidan in February. I wouldn't say that it was, you know, that the legal nuances of this deal were not one of the key focuses of discussion there. But certainly, you know, there were in one of the union buildings there that had been taken over by protesters, there were regular policy discussions. And, you know, these issues certainly came up. There are many other ways, including most prominently with natural gas, that Russia has also previously both offered carrots to Ukraine and used them as leverage, both over individual politicians through alleged corruption and over the state itself and its ability to finance itself. So this was nothing new for Ukrainians to experience. That it escalated it and guaranteed it would escalate to this sort of level of the international economic order. And, you know, it ultimately required the IMF to change its rules, which, you know, the Kremlin was very angry about, and Dmitry Medvedev, Putin's placeholder president and once and future prime minister, called opening the Pandora's box of the rules of international finance, although it was Russia that had sort of started the fight in the first place. But it guaranteed that it would escalate to that level. As soon as that contract was signed in December of 2013, it meant that if the conflict in Ukraine didn't end up with it becoming, you know, part of Russia's vision of the world and beholden to the Kremlin, that this fight was going to escalate to that level, even without the sanctions response that then followed.
Yeah. And then the Russians, as, you know, as the conflict with Ukraine, the 2014 conflict with the annexation of Crimea and the Russian support for Russophones in the eastern part of the country, as that emerges and the Russians face sanctions, immediately the conversation turns to Russia's energy policies. That in particular, it's the way in which Europe had become increasingly dependent on Russia for its energy needs. And I know you detail this when you talk about some of the Nord Stream these projects. Is this Russia trying to ensure that whatever sanctions are going to be put in place, that they've actually got a pretty powerful cudgel, pretty powerful, you know, means by which to try to oppose it?
Yeah, I think for the Kremlin, it was certain, the Kremlin was very surprised when after the full scale invasion in February of 2022, the European countries were all fully on board with the very serious sanctions, the sort of highest level that could be targeted, the blacklisting of its central bank, were all on board. But it was up until that point proven right. And, you know, these economic networks and linkages very much did keep Europe hesitant. And even some of the sanctions that ultimately Europe did agree to, the sectoral sanctions, which, you know, again, they were structured as deterrent tools. You know, they had a state capacity impact, but they were structured as deterrent tools. And as I mentioned earlier, I'm critical of sanctions and sort of that effect. But the Europeans did come on board with them and did see that a response was more necessary only after the shootdown of MH17, the Malaysian Airlines plane, en route from Amsterdam, that was shot down over Ukraine in July of 2014. But then, you know, even after that, Europe wasn't necessarily fully committed to enforcing them. And, you know, we know of European companies who were involved in the construction of the bridge in Crimea, whereas, you know, rather than the sort of financial sanctions that the sectoral sanctions represent that were sort of the brunt of controversy, that was, you know, what everybody did. Agreed to immediately after, don't invest in Russia's occupation of Crimea. And those weren't enforced. A lot of the ones for very large companies weren't enforced. Politicians saw their interests elsewhere. Russia in particular used the networks around Nord Stream to try to gain influence over key politicians in Germany. But one thing I sort of do want to highlight is, you know, yes, Europe became more dependent on Russian energy throughout, but what is sort of remarkable and I think speaks a little bit to the Putin regime is particularly in Germany, this idea of using economic interdependence as a way that Germany could use to manage relations with Russia and make Russia less likely to be aggressive, you know, predates the collapse of the Soviet Union by 20 years with Ostpolitik. Pipelines of both oil and gas began to be, you know, built even at that time. And I think what, you know, Germany and some of those other countries particularly failed to understand with their own view of that interdependence was that they were dealing with a regime in Vladimir Putin's Kremlin that was, you know, had no democratic accountability, no responsibility to ensure the welfare of its people or systems to challenge Putin's ideas, whether they're better for it. So, you know, economic interdependence only works when there's an interest both ways. And it certainly would be the topic of a whole other conversation to compare, you know, why it may have helped in the Soviet era and didn't with Putin's regime. But sometimes it does come down to the individual.
No, absolutely. And that would be a fascinating question, certainly for international relations theorists in talking about the role that economic interdependence plays in conflict resolution. But in that period prior to 2022, Russia sought out some really interesting partners. There's one I want to really emphasize because that chapter was absolutely fascinating to me. What role does Venezuela play in all of this? It seems like Venezuela played, you know, seemed to play a larger role than I even imagined.
Yeah, so, you know, Venezuela, which has been governed by initially the regime of Hugo Chavez and then his successor, has long had economic relations with Russia under this leftist government that challenges sort of the U.S.'s position, also through, you know, built up relations with Cuba, but of course has its own very deep economic interdependencies with the U.S., in particular the role of U.S. oil companies there. But the Kremlin saw a kindred sort of spirit in Chavez and in the regime there, particularly the head of Russia's state oil company, Rosneft, Igor Sechin, had a very close personal relationship with him and actually had been the Russian, sort of sat as the chair of this Russian Intergovernmental Commission for Relations with Venezuela from the earliest days of the Putin administration. And you know, but when the West began with this sanctions agenda, Russia really saw it as a place that it could gain an economic foothold in the West with the ability to have some of the key leverage tools with oil production, again, investing very heavily in that sector, and also in the future in natural gas, which, you know, became such a key part of this conflict and I think will play a key role in the economics of international relations, certainly for the next few years going forward. But then, of course, Venezuela's relations with the U.S. continued to deteriorate. Venezuela itself was hit by major sanctions in the Trump administration. And Russia also used it then as sort of a experimental environment to test out some of its own ideas for challenging this order. So it sent specialists to help them work on an alternate cryptocurrency that could trade out, you know, digitally and on the dark web and in theory be outside the reach of U.S. sanctions. You know, I think throughout this period, we've shown that sanctions are just as effective against crypto companies and the like as they are against traditional financial companies, and the idea that by holding a cryptocurrency, you'll somehow get past U.S. Law on that is nonsense. And that currency itself doesn't trade even on, you know, the sketchiest of crypto markets today. So it's sort of a evidence of how it was a failure. But also, you know, Russia's support there helped keep that regime alive. You know, I wouldn't say it played a determinant role, but made U.S. policy there and showed that U.S. sanctions could, you know, not necessarily be ineffective, but could be fought against if countries like Russia and Venezuela, and to a certain extent in that example, China, were willing to work together.
When we come back, this economic conflict between Russia and the West started before the 2022 Russian invasion of Ukraine. How has the war in Ukraine affected it? What role might China play? Stay with us.
Everything in life is a negotiation.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The economic war between Russia and the West is raging. Will the West remain unified in confronting Russia in this economic war? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're discussing the economic conflict between Russia and the West, partially captured by the sanctions regime placed on Russia, beginning in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea and intensifying in 2022 after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Our guest today is Maximilian Hess. He is a Central Asia Fellow in the Eurasia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and the author of a new book on this topic, Economic War, Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. So, Max, I guess the next question, when talking about seeking out allies and seeking out ways to try to wage this economic conflict, the real key potential ally for Russia has to be China. I've read in different places that, for instance, the Russian ruble, you know, didn't really collapse in 2014 like a lot of people thought that it might, because the Chinese pretty aggressively kind of bailed the Russians out and tried to, you know, ensure that the sanctions didn't have as much punishment as they could have. I guess, first of all, how accurate is that? And if so, how important is China as a partner to Russia in this ongoing conflict?
Sure. So I'll actually kind of reverse that order and then speak a little further on where China's going. But firstly, you know, I always caveat this with, I'm a Russia watcher. You know, I speak Russian and some other regional languages. You know, I don't claim any expertise in China. But China, of course, is a key figure in this international economic order and is the aspirant power challenging it. But from, you know, sort of my view, is, I think that as a result of this conflict, Russia wants to destroy the international economic order, whereas China is broadly happy with the international economic order. It just wants to replace itself as the center, right? Belt and Road loans tend to be issued in dollars. China still has a closed capital market, so it knows that its currency isn't going to be in the position to challenge the U.S. as that global reserve currency anytime soon. But it signs, arbitration agreements. It sets up bilateral investment treaties. And it wants those courts and the like to be in China. It's not a member of the Paris Club, one of the sort of key institutions of ultimate government finance. And that's what sits in a lot of the issues with recent debt disputes. But, when Xi and Putin, just a few weeks before the war declared, friendship without limits, I actually, just before the full-scale invasion, I actually think that we've seen throughout this conflict that Russia and China's relationship near that. And the 2014 ruble example is one because, yes, China did begin expanding credit offerings to Russia in response to the West's restrictions. But ultimately, the biggest collapse in the ruble came at the end of 2014 when Western sanctions had stopped the Russian state oil company Rosneft from being able to borrow long term in dollars. It had a $11 billion bill come due for a two-year loan that it had used to buy up a company called TNKB. A joint venture between three Russian international businessmen and the British company BP, and needed to refinance that. And rather than China refinancing the loan, the Kremlin had to engage in some financial engineering that effectively meant that it printed rubles to give those dollars from the central bank to the company, sold all this ruble debt, and caused the big collapse in the ruble there. So, I think that China's ultimate position is one where today, right, it declares that friendship. It says it's however it's trying to negotiate peace. But, looking at the conflict as it stands now, Putin needs a far greater expansion in Chinese credit to replace the lost access to Western markets. It was less than 6 months after that conflict in 2014, that China agreed to the Kashagan of Siberia pipeline, the first big new pipeline resource for Russia to open up that market and give it an alternate from Europe. And now, a year and a half into this conflict, although they've been talking about it at that meeting just a few weeks before the war began, we still have no agreement on the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline. And then third is on direct military aid. So the three things Putin wants: new pipeline agreement, large amounts of loans, direct military aid, China hasn't given him. So I don't think China is fully on board with Russia's agenda. And something that, from my vantage point that I worry about is that if we risk pushing China too much into Russia's corner, I argue in the book that ultimately this isn't an economic war that Russia can win. But it is one that the West can lose through disunity and through a fractured approach. And Russia does its best to try to make the West more likely to do that. And so, viewing it from that example, I don't think that there's any kind of, despite Putin's talks of the BRICS agenda and this new BRICS currency, right? He can't even go to the summit that's going to be held next week because of South Africa's integration into this order and frank need for IMF support rather immediately, which it will not get if, it hosted Putin for that summit, in my view. I don't think China and Russia fully see eye to eye. But if China were to be pushed fully into joining the Russian fight here, it would be, it would turn it from an economic war into a real, genuine economic world.
Absolutely. But you spoke of Western unity, and of course, Western unity, is being challenged. I think of in Europe in particular, Russia's political campaigns support for some of the more right-wing political movements, and most notably has been Viktor Orban in Hungary. He doesn't have all that much support in Poland, but we started seeing in some places concerns about the rise of Giorgia Meloni in Italy, and the possibility of a Marine Le Pen victory in France is sort of across the board. Is that threat of a lack of unity on the part of the West, the Western unity vis-a-vis Russia, it seems to have been overblown thus far, but how committed is Russia in trying to create some sort of distance between the EU and the US on these issues?
I mean, I think Russia's been dedicated to it for a long time. Some of the examples that you mentioned are some of the more prominent ones. I do think for institutional reasons, it's even more difficult in some of those larger European countries. So where I worry about some of its efforts more are in smaller ones, you know, in Austria, in particular, which serves as a key gas hub for where sort of all of the pipelines that come into Europe from the east, from the north and the south all ultimately intersect, to Bulgaria, which is actually sort of a positive news story because they've finally formed a technocratic government after five elections in a few years in which Russia was often the key issue that appears to be making more progress, although one of the two constituent parties there has long been accused of having corrupt relations with the Kremlin and oil imports there in particular. So, you know, sometimes I worry about it more on the periphery, in particular with, you know, Europe's need for unanimity on a lot of issues. It's also very willing to partner, you know, because the far right has sort of been ascendant in recent years, it's found its sort of best allies there, but has also partnered with, you know, left-wing parties in previous points, particularly likes to look out for corruption. You know, the role of Malta and Cyprus are ones that I only sort of scratch the surface on, but where it's had a particular influence over those years as well. And I think the Kremlin will only redouble its dedication to those efforts, you know, with this war going on.
And then one example I have to ask about is Erdogan in Turkey, because traditionally, you would imagine Turkey would want to take advantage of Russian weakness, in particular, projection of power in places like the South Caucasus region. But Erdogan has been, well, I guess I'll let you describe it. Does Erdogan support Putin? Does Turkey support Russia in this conflict? Or are they on the side of the West?
So, you know, it's a cliche to say Turkey is between the East and the West. And, you know, oftentimes books start off with bits about the Bosporus and Europe meeting Asia and the history. And I find those all kind of cliches. But the reality is that it's true. And so, you know, in the book, I use a particularly fun story out of Southern California involving a reality TV show star that I won't give away. Who is on one side doing business with Russia and on the other side trying to become this real estate reality TV show star, very much in the mold of the 45th president of the United States. And so, you know, I think that, you know, Erdogan and his policy has really been about trying to advance Turkey's interests as Russia's sort of involvement in the Eastern Mediterranean increased over this time as well, in particular in Syria, right on Turkey's borders. It took on another aspect there. But, you know, Turkey is very much on its own side, and I don't think fully on one side or the other. And I don't know how sustainable that is. But, you know, if we take just the last 6 months, Turkey's been taking a lot more actions that are seen as in the West's interest. If we take the 6 months before that, it was very much the opposite. And, you know, I expect Erdogan to sort of try to continue with that pendulum and only really make a firm break when it's clear where the chips are going to lie.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the ongoing economic conflict with the author of a new book called Economic War, Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. The author is Maximilian Haas. Max, since you had mentioned about, you know, sort of the last 6 months, this was a case that has really developed probably since, you know, certainly since you wrote this, but the Black Sea grain deal that Russia had negotiated, you know, with the UN, negotiated with Ukraine, that could have some profound implications, and certainly in places, food insecure places like in Africa. How do you see that the breakdown of that deal in the context of the issues that you've raised? Is this Russia trying to play hardball, or is it really just Russia trying to deny Ukraine resources they can use to fight?
So you know, I think one, it's certainly about, you know, denying Ukraine the resources and the finances. But of course, you know, Ukraine is so dependent on Western financing at this point that, you know, whether it exports record amounts of grain or none at all, I actually don't think is going to make the difference there. I see it as part of, you know, Russia's strategy. And this is something I think we should be very much looking towards for the next 6 months, is Russia has understood that it was using its weaponization of natural gas last year and some of the other commodities coming out of this conflict to stoke global inflation and to hope that that would break Western unity. I think Russia, and especially now that inflation is coming down and the gas prices have settled and that market in particular has adapted, although it remains fragile in many ways, for other ways to sort of keep that tension up. I actually think that, you know, from the pure economics perspective, the threat from disruptions to Ukrainian and Russian grain, of course, you know, Ukraine has shown that it has the ability to target Russian shipping in that area as well, is not as grave as it was last year, whereas some of the other concerns really are. You know, other countries have adjusted their planting, France, Brazil, and a number of others. It could obviously have a huge impact in the event of adverse weather conditions in a number of places, but also Ukraine's increased ability to get some of that out via European countries as well, although there certainly are tensions around that, particularly with Poland and Hungary. You know, other one that I have real concern about, though, is oil, right? Russia's Taman and Novorossiysk ports are also on that Black Sea, are huge outlets for Russian oil to get out into the world. And, you know, one of the sort of very unique things about the West strategy is recognizing that how dominant an oil power Russia is, and that, you know, Putin's greatest success, I argue, in the sort of 2014 to 2022 period was building up this partnership with Mohammed bin Salman and OPEC Plus in Saudi Arabia, even as sort of the general narrative was, oh, that Trump and, you know, MBS are going to be best friends and do horrible things together. MBS, I think, very much sort of outsmarted him in that case. And, you know, the disruption there could have huge impacts. Kazakh oil, you know, more than 70% of Kazakh oil also flows through that port. The West oil cap, and recognizing this, cap, U.S. officials have repeatedly said, no, we want Russian oil to get out into the world, because otherwise, you know, without it, global oil prices could spike to $200 or other unprecedented levels. But also that, the cap is in place to try to limit those. And so I think that we're going to see a lot of tensions around the Black Sea, even if they're not around immediate grain, potentially play into that. And the Kremlin used them to try to keep inflationary and economic pressures high. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of hint at in the book, and that I worry about, even now, and perhaps in some ways more since then, is, you know, Russia has its own options to effectively say, we're not going to export any more oil, and to try to drive that, you know, price up, unless there's some kind of agreement that comes to our basis. And, you know, a sustained oil price at that level would, you know, rapidly impoverish many countries around the world, and certainly also trigger a global a recession in the West and internationally. And a lot depends there on, you know, how Saudi Arabia would respond. But I think Putin is willing, you know, I worry a lot more about Putin using that as sort of the Kremlin's nuclear economic weapon, you know, hundreds of steps before the escalation ladder. I worry anything about, you know, nuclear conflict. And you know, that Russia could try to force something on its terms through doing that. And I think that Putin, you know, even though that oil is so important to the lifeblood of the Russian economy, and today where Russia's spending more than a third of its government budget on the military, to the military itself, I think that's Putin is willing to do that, and has shown throughout that he's willing to impose costs on the Russian population to achieve his vision.
Now, it does seem, especially the way you frame this, is Russia trying to use inflation, and definitely, although inflation rates, particularly in the United States, are quite low, the perception that inflation is still out of control is driven by oil prices. And so all of that kind of creating a scenario where the West is at least starting to indicate perhaps a fatigue, kind of a Ukraine fatigue and anti-Russia fatigue that's being, you know, represented in some of the political discourses, particularly partisan discourses in the US and, you know, and across Western Europe. So how concerned are you then, since so much of this has become the West and Russia being locked into this economic conflict, that, you know, Russians just have much more patience for this, and the possibility of sort of Western fatigue over inflation rates and even gas prices that aren't spinning out of control, but it doesn't take terribly much to anger American voters.
No, I certainly think that's true. And, you know, what I would say is, you know, despite the, particularly in the U.S., as you mentioned, you know, better headline inflation numbers and sort of sign that we've beaten it, it is a real risk that they go up through the direct result of Russia's action again. And, you know, at its sort of most ambitious, maybe that's something that I hope the book helps achieve in, you know, making clear that, no, what's actually responsible for that price at the pump, you know, there's been mockery on certain television channels in the U.S. and from certain politicians about, you know, oh, you know, these economic issues being caused by this economic war in Ukraine. But I think that, you know, anybody with a clear understanding of how the international economy works can see that that very much is the case. And actually, you know, that is one of the costs of globalization. And, you know, even natural gas wasn't such a globalized market 10 years ago, right? What happened with prices in Asia and in Europe had almost no impact on the price in the U.S. But now with the development of LNG and gas traded as a commodity and futures contracts enabling that and all the financing behind that actually, you know, supporting the dollar system to bring it back to that. But this globalization, you know, at the same time, making what happens in any one market more susceptible to the others. And yes, you know, as I said earlier, I worry that the West's disunity is its greatest risk to it. One thing that, you know, I think it's important for us to remember is, you know, even the inflation shock of last year and the economic difficulties that were experienced after are nothing compared to, I mean, one, the cost, you know, often Putin has imposed on his own people and certainly on the Ukrainian ones, but two, the cost that the West and the United States in particular would experience from its primacy and arguably the U.S.'s even hegemony in that international economic order. Losing that position would be far more economically devastating over the long term.
And then obviously, since the U.S. plays such a huge role in this, it seems to me one of the greatest foreign policy accomplishments has been of President Biden has been giving the Europeans much more of a voice in some of these sanctions. I think about cutting off the Nord Stream and the SWIFT system and, you know, some of the more damning of that, that not only was there no opposition in Europe, it seemed like the Europeans were even, you know, leading some of this. So how important is it that this is not the U.S. taking a position and informing the Europeans that this is precisely what you're going to do, and instead much more of a multilateral partnership between European countries and the U.S. The U.S. is always going to be a leader, but there's different ways to lead.
You know, I think on the European question, it's particularly important, and it's a very good one to raise because, you know, I think there's kind of a misunderstanding often, or at least not an appreciation of all the dynamics of the U.S.-European relationship and how important it is for this international economic order. And I'll try not to give the whole technical explanation, but, you know, for countries like Russia, Saudi Arabia, the BRICS countries largely that, you know, Russia views as this potential alternate economic bloc, what they really need is they need a deficit market to invest their excess savings into. And there's a very good book came out maybe 2 years ago, Trade Wars or Class Wars, that discusses some of the aspects of this for the United States in particular. But, you know, these deficit markets, you know, essentially absorb those excess savings and are really needed for any alternative currency order to come into place. Now, the one actual true success story, despite the, you know, European financial crisis of 2011-2012, in recent decades of a new currency coming and playing a systemic role has been the euro. And actually, Europe is the one continent in the world where most trade invoices between countries are not done in dollars. You know, even between China and Thailand or Vietnam or between Brazil and South Africa, the 90%+ of trade invoices globally are in dollars, except for in Europe. And essentially the bargain that the United States, in my view, has with the Europe and the European Union in particular, Britain has a sort of somewhat different relationship, but broadly similar, is that These countries remain active, enthusiastic, and loyal members of that international economic order in exchange for U.S. security guarantees. For me, I'm far less concerned about whether Spain is spending 2% of GDP on defense per NATO, because even if Spain spends 10% of GDP per NATO, it's not going to have a material impact on the West's defense posturing, just given how large the U.S. Defense budgets are and how important its security position in Europe is. I think an understanding of that relationship, and that's why I worry about some of the discussion in Europe recently about strategic autonomy. Emmanuel Macron in France, because if Europe were to take another path with its currency, which has its own institutional relations around the world, some of which are quite controversial at the moment, West African, Central African franc, and its position in Niger. But the euro could really serve as an alternative, or if Europe writ large was willing to support the emergence of a BRICS alliance, then it could really make an alternative currency system from one of those countries viable as well. I think working together with Europe and making it clear that it's a partnership and making that sort of trade-off more explicit, right? If Europe wants to be, Europe does want to be part of the U.S. security order, and in exchange is part of the U.S. economic order, and making clear that those two go hand in hand through cooperation, rather than focusing on things like, whether one small European country is spending 2% of GDP on defense, I think are far more important.
No, absolutely. And I think that's one of the real values of the book, is that we hear a lot in the press about these economic issues. But I think you do a wonderful job of framing this in a much larger context, as well as providing details on a lot of issues that we read a bit about, but get explained in much more detail. The title of the book is Economic War: Ukraine and the Global Conflict Between Russia and the West. The author is Maximilian Hess, Central Asia Fellow in the Eurasia Program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and the founder of a London-based political risk firm and Metena Advisory. And I absolutely recommend that you pick up the book. Thank you very much, Professor Hess, for joining us, explaining a number of the concepts, and hopefully getting a lot of people quite interested in this wonderful book. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. And our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.